Nikki created this persona, Paulina, this mom of a very young child, and was very effectively able to infiltrate numerous groups. You had to be invited, you had to be vetted, but she was able to infiltrate a lot of them and then build up individual relationships with different people in the groups who were engaged in various kinds of illicit activity.
I actually brought my daughter's stroller and put a doll and covered it with blankets for looks, for him to be able to say, oh, this really is, like, there really is a child there. And he walked up to me and he had khakis and a pink polo and was a 30-something year old. The first thing he did was go to the stroller and look. And he said, Paulina, and then he went immediately to the stroller to look at the child, and then he was arrested.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guests today are former FBI Special Agent Nikki Badalato, head of the FBI's Child Exploitation Task Force, and Rolling Stone reporter Alex Morris. They're here to talk about the horrific and growing problem of underage sex crimes in America. Nikki and Alex are going to tell us the truth about how widespread these crimes are, the kinds of people who commit them, the common ways they're commissioned, and the victims who are sometimes only infants. They're going to tell us how the problem is much more widespread, insidious, and homegrown than most people imagine, and how, according to the Department of Health and Human Services, 199,000 American minors are sexually exploited each year. In Nikki Badalato's two-decade undercover career investigating underage sex crimes, she estimates that she arrested more than 1,000 people, and not one of those cases failed to end in a conviction. It's my great honor to welcome reporter Alex Morris and former FBI undercover agent Nikki Badalato as today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Good morning to both of you, and thank you so much for doing this. Let's start with Alex. A fantastic article, really important, powerful piece. Can you tell us a little bit about your background and sort of how you became interested in the subject and how the article came about?
Yeah, sure. Also, thank you so much for those kind words, Ralph, and for having us on today.
Oh, my pleasure.
So I have been a journalist now for almost 2 decades, and I've reached a point in my career where people now, sometimes people come to me with stories, just because they've read stuff that I have written before. And I've written a few sort of true crime pieces in the past. And so someone reached out, who had friends in the FBI, and knew Nikki, and thought that her experience and her story was not only fascinating, but it was important, that she had information about sex trafficking and exploitation of minors that is not typically what is covered. And so I was very intrigued from the beginning. But Nikki and I set up an initial call, and I just thought she was amazing.
Yeah.
I fell in love with her, and I felt like we would be, you know, it would be a good match. When I work on an article like this, it typically takes months, several months. And so we, you know, I knew we would be spending a lot of time together, and I was just raring to go.
Mm-hmm. So Nikki, amazing, amazing career. And thank you for your tremendous service to our country. It's so important, and it's such a difficult area. Can you talk a little bit about your background and how you got into this particular specialty within the FBI?
Well, thank you very much for highlighting this article and the work that Alex and I are trying to present and make a difference and make awareness. As far as my career, I always say that the FBI found me. I didn't find the FBI. I grew up in Washington, D.C., and everybody works for the government there.
Yeah.
And they recruited me out of high school. Mm-hmm. So I started with the FBI when I was 18, 2 weeks after I turned 18 years old.
Mm-hmm. Nikki, you got to tell the whole story.
Well, I will say that I showed up my first day, the little, I always call myself the skinny little 100-pound, 5'4" little girl walking in with a red dress and red heels. That's what I decided to walk in my first day in the FBI.
Not like a usual image kind of FBI. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Great. And first it seems like you were in the drug trafficking area. Is that correct?
When I first started at 18, obviously I wasn't an agent. I went through various administrative positions over the course of almost 10 years before, at the age of 28, I was in the academy as an agent. Mm-hmm. And after graduating the FBI Academy in 2002, I went to Atlanta, was my first field office. I worked bank robberies for just a short period of time, and then I worked crimes against children for my first 2 years, basically. Mm-hmm. And I'll be very honest, like for me, where the Bureau assigns you when as a new agent is kind of random, to be very honest with you. Mm-hmm. So them putting me in crimes against children, I had no background in cyber or anything like that. So I kind of was like learning on the job.
Yeah.
And my eyes were wide open quickly in learning about the fetishes and just the things that were going on online with children that I had never, ever heard of before in my life. So I think I was as shocked as anybody who has never heard of it before.
Yeah.
I was just as shocked. And so I just learned as I went along.
And I don't think I knew this before I worked on this story, but in order to be an agent with the FBI, you have to have graduated from college. Mm-hmm. So while working a full-time job, while being a single mom, Nikki put herself through college at night.
Wow.
And then applied to the FBI. And I think it was right after 9/11, mm-hmm. got, you know, sent to Quantico for 16 weeks. And so I think all of that backstory, I was pretty fascinated to learn that.
So I left the FBI and was with the ATF for a very short period of time. Mm-hmm. And I swore in because the FBI, before 9/11, the FBI had a hiring freeze for agents. And I'd finally gotten my degree. My daughter was very young, but I wanted to become an agent. And the FBI was, like I said, had a hiring freeze, and the ATF hired me very quickly because I wanted to get an 1811 special agent position. So they hired me, and I swore in on September 10th.
Wow.
01.
Wow.
The day before. And so my second day as an ATF agent, I didn't even have a desk yet, and I'm sitting in a conference room, and I'm watching 9/11 unfold.
Oh, my God.
And so I went through the ATF Academy, and at the end of 01, the FBI called me back and said, you were at the brink of being hired. We're filling classes every 2 weeks starting January 1 after 9/11. And do you want to come back? Mm-hmm. And I already had 10 years with the FBI. And I said, absolutely. So I went through the ATF Academy in October, and I went through the FBI Academy in April of 02.
Wow.
And also, I know this because I've talked to you about it, but can you describe a little bit how you felt when you were watching 9/11 unfold in the ATF offices?
My feeling was that I was in the wrong place, to be very honest with you. I mean, I had served with the FBI for all of my adult life. I basically was raised, I always say I was raised in the FBI. They were my family, and that's where I grew up, and that's what I knew. And so I felt like I was in the wrong place, if that makes sense, in some way, that I wasn't where I should be serving at that time, which is probably not fair to the ATF, but it just has how I felt with my service at that point.
Uh-huh. Can you talk about the numbers for a minute?
Yeah.
Because they are shocking.
Absolutely. So one of the things that was really interesting to me when I started kicking the tires on this story and talking to Nikki is that she mainly worked in the Midwest. And I think I had gone into the research of this article with misconceptions that a lot of people have that trafficking is at least a lot of the main problems with trafficking in America are people being trafficked across the borders.
Yeah.
And certainly that's happening. And Nikki could probably speak to that better than I could. But when I started really digging in, what I found was that while there are, it's the Justice Department has estimated that there's between 14,500 and 17,500 foreigners trafficked into America every year. Mm-hmm. This is like actually a really small number compared to the number of American minors. And I'm just talking about minors who they believe are trafficked within it. So I do want to sort of preface this by saying that these numbers, it's very hard to find super reliable numbers. It's very hard to know. I mean, so many of these cases are not reported.
Yeah.
You know, so much of it is happening underground. So I do want to give these numbers with that caveat. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we're talking about somewhere in the order of several hundred American minors who are believed to be sexually exploited each year. And certainly
several hundred thousand, right?
Several hundred thousand, excuse me. Yes. And you know, maybe another several hundred thousand on top of that, that are considered to be at risk of being trafficked.
Yeah.
You know, you can dig into the data and sort of see how people arrived at these numbers. And I would venture to say that they might actually be low.
Yeah.
I mean, I would certainly want Nikki to weigh in on that. But one thing, you know, when talking to people who work in this field, one thing I was told was that if you go to any high school in America, and you'll find a few kids who are being trafficked, and the trafficking may not look the way you think of when you think of sort of
action movies and stuff.
But nonetheless, these kids are doing sexual acts as a barter for something.
Yeah.
They're being used in a economic system in which they are trading sexual acts.
Just absolutely shocking. And Nikki, had you done undercover work before you joined the sex trafficking unit?
No, that was when I first started.
Okay. And how did you develop, because I thought that was very interesting, how you develop your undercover persona?
They sent me to specialized training to do the online undercover work. And it basically was a period where a lot of the creating a new niche was kind of new. And so I was a young agent, young mother, and I realized one thing that they've been training that I learned was that there was a, an entire group of individuals that were interested in young children, like under the age of 5.
God.
And so I decided to create one persona and create that niche. And it just, it was... I've said this a million times, I guess, as agents, and that maybe it sounds, very impersonal, but like shooting fish in the barrel, basically.
Yeah. Wow.
The people that would come out of the woodwork that were interested in me as a 28-year-old mother of a 3-year-old child interested in pedophilia.
God. You tell the story in the article about your first undercover case. Could you recount that?
Stephen Boland. He was my first arrest. Yes. So actually he was one of my, a lot of these individuals, I spent a lot of time online, different hours of the day on the phone, some of them for months at a time, developing so-called relationships and gaining their trust and seeing whether or not they actually were going to do these overt acts to perpetuate their desire. But with Stephen Boland, it was very quick. Mm-hmm. It was actually within a couple of weeks when we first started speaking. He was actually in Atlanta. A lot of the people I spoke with were in different states around the country and the world. And so we spoke, and at first he was, it didn't take him very long for him to get comfortable. At first he was not. Mm-hmm. But when I sent a picture of my daughter, at the time we were allowed to do that, it was a picture of the side of my daughter's face, and not obviously fully, obviously she was fully clothed, but but it showed that I had a daughter. It was proof of life, right? Proof of of me having a child. And he immediately switched gears, and we met within a couple of weeks. And so the meeting was set where he was going to get a hotel room in North Atlanta, and we met at a mall. I actually brought my daughter's stroller and put a doll and covered it with blankets just for, I guess, for looks, for him to be able to say, oh, this really is, like, there really is a child there.
Right.
And he walked up to me, and he had khakis and a pink polo, and was a 30-something year old, relatively handsome young guy. And I, as I'm sitting there, as I told Alex, I guess I was hoping he wouldn't show up.
Yeah.
I was hoping this wouldn't really happen.
Right.
And then when he did show up, and he looked like he could be someone that was sitting across the cubicle from me in my office, I was kind of shocked. You know, I think all of us want it to be the Chester molester we have in our brain.
Yeah, right? Sure.
The look of that. And so
it's easier. Yeah.
It's easier to wrap your mind around that. Right.
Right. Absolutely.
But it very much wasn't that. And the first thing he did was go to the stroller and look. And he said, Paulina. And then he went immediately to the stroller to look at the child. And then he was arrested.
Yeah. And he thought he was there to have sex with a 3-year-old girl.
With a 3-year-old child. And he had the hotel key in his pocket already. He had already gotten the hotel room.
And how shocking was that to you, to see somebody who looks like could be your next door neighbor?
It was shocking, honestly.
And he was a father, right?
Right.
He was a father. He had children.
He had a child. And he also, his wife, he had a 3-year-old child, a girl. And his wife was pregnant with their son. And we were never able to determine whether or not, because the child was so young, whether or not anything actually happened with his own child, but disturbing nonetheless.
A study conducted by the University of Pennsylvania School of Social Work estimated that as many as 300,000 American youth may be at risk of commercial sexual exploitation at any time. According to the Department of Homeland Security, sex trafficking has become one of the fastest growing criminal enterprises, estimated to bring in $150 billion globally each year. The Rape, Abuse, and Incest National Network, AINN, which is our nation's largest anti-sexual violence organization, reports that 1 in 9 girls and 1 in 20 boys under the age of 18 experience sexual abuse or assault, and 82% of all victims of sexual assault are female. Victims are 4 times more likely to develop symptoms of drug abuse and 4 times more likely to experience PTSD as adults. Alex, could you talk about how, I'm sure this, you know, this has existed for a long time, and we just were not aware of it as much as we are now, but it seems as though the internet and all of these websites and porn sites have just sort of like given these people almost like a forum, an ability to reach out and to find people. Can you talk to that?
Yeah. So when Nikki was talking previously about the training that she was doing and how the FBI was, you know, it was kind of a new thing.
Yeah.
And they were sort of figuring out how to do this kind of undercover work and how to infiltrate these groups. The reason it was a new thing is because at that point in time, the internet wasn't really, I mean, the internet had been around a while, but the ability to sort of buy and sell things on the internet was fairly new. I believe, if I'm getting this, my numbers right, the first sort of widespread internet, you know, very lucrative, profitable, widespread internet porn site was started in the 90s. Mm-hmm. And this was just, you know, the early 2000s. So once porn started to be a thing that was really happening online, unfortunately, what was determined was that the most profitable and the most popular kind of porn that was circulating on the internet was child abuse imagery, which is not referred to as porn because it's obviously not consensual, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So those images were really starting to circulate and they were making people a lot of money.
Yeah.
And so there was an incentive to make more of them.
Yeah.
Which means obviously more child abuse.
Right.
The FBI was catching on to this and they were trying to figure out what to do about it.
Yeah.
And Nikki was part of that early training. Probably some of the agents, you know, we talked about it a little bit, like building the plane while you're flying it, you know, they were the first sort of guard trying to figure out what to do. And so this training, a lot of it, as Nikki explained to me, was first of all, figuring out how to infiltrate the online groups where these images were being circulated. Mm-hmm. You know, there were two different groups of people. There were people who were really only interested in the images.
Yeah.
And then there are people who are interested in more.
Yeah.
And both of those things were legal, obviously different violations. But Nikki and she obviously could speak to this better than I could, but she created this persona, Paulina, mm-hmm. was this mom of a very young child and was very effectively able to infiltrate numerous groups. There were a lot of checks and balances. These groups were not, you know, you couldn't just click a button and join them.
Right.
Tell them you had to be invited. You had to be vetted.
Right.
But she was able to infiltrate a lot of them and then build up individual relationships with different people in the groups who were engaged in various kinds of illicit activity. One of her early arrests was bringing down, and again, Nikki, you should talk to this, but the, what were they called? The,
PT Cruisers?
Yeah, the PT Cruisers, which stands for Preteen Cruisers.
Right.
Oh my God.
And that, if I'm correct, was imagery, trading and selling imagery. Is that right?
It was both. I met some of my subjects within that group that ended up traveling. Dan Haas, who ended up going to trial. But it was over 200 people internationally that we ended up taking down that group that were...
Wow. It was a coordinated effort.
Correct.
And travelers are what the people who want to actually act upon these predilections are called travelers.
Yeah, they have all these code words, it seems like. Yeah.
Right.
Because many of them are traveling to meet children.
Right. Nikki, over your career, you've prosecuted like 1,000 of these cases, something like that. And every one has been successful, which is an amazing record and, you know, commend you for that.
Thank you.
It seems like a whole hidden part of this is the grooming aspect of it. And you talk about in the article how there's a high percentage of these children are brought into this through their families, mm-hmm. which is also kind of sickening. Can you talk about the grooming process, like how these guys meet these kids, how they spot vulnerable kids in schools and on chat lines, and how that whole process happens?
Do you have children?
I do. I have 4 children.
Okay. Do you have like teenage children?
They're all in their 20s, but they were teenagers.
I'm only asking because I guess I'm trying to reference the fact that how vulnerable, especially as young children and teens are to being manipulated. Okay.
Right.
So
as a parent, you have to be very sensitive to how they're spending their time on the internet and who they're talking to and all that kind of stuff.
Right. And the fact that they're so accessible through, I mean, if you looked at TikTok, Roblox, there's a Calculator Plus app, it's a hidden app that they can actually get in contact with them. I mean, the access to our children is unbelievable.
Yeah.
And their vulnerability to be manipulated is as we all know, we've all been there, we've all seen it, right? Yeah. So I guess being vigilant is one thing to say, being aware is another thing. That's why I hope that we can do more in schools to have more of an open conversation about these type of things. Mm-hmm. I mean, as parents, we don't want to think that this is possible. Yeah. I don't know how many times I've gone out to talk to a 12-year-old or a 13-year-old who has sent images to a guy, and I have to go out and I have to say, this is now being sent around the internet and you can't pull it back, right? You can't. Yeah. Once it's out there, it's gone.
Right. It starts out as an innocent conversation.
Absolutely.
But then it's being, your picture is being, and your name is being spread to this whole network of people.
Exactly. And you can't get it back.
Yeah. Right?
You can't undo that.
It's a predatory activity.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And the kids are just, you know, they're vulnerable because they're on the internet. They think they're talking to a friend or whatever.
Absolutely. They think they're talking to some really cute 17-year-old or someone who's telling them they're beautiful when they don't feel beautiful, or they're, you know, the grooming process is really not difficult for for our children.
Yeah.
To be honest with you.
Yeah. And, you know, this is the most disturbing thing for me, is that it just seems to be part of a whole breakdown in our society, because kids are so vulnerable to this. And there are so many kids who feel vulnerable because they're not getting attention from their families, or they've got emotional issues based on dysfunctional families and so on and so forth. Is that something that you saw a lot of?
People came from all different backgrounds, right? Like, these victims come from all different backgrounds. You know, you can talk about inner city and poverty and broken families and whatever that means. But but honestly, it's everywhere, and and the unfortunate thing that people need to realize is that everybody is susceptible to it. I did a presentation to a local school in my little nice little suburb up here west of St. Louis. And at the end of it, two of the students in that school had already been identified as being trafficked, right? And
wow.
So it's everywhere.
I mean, one thing that is, I think, slightly different from maybe how kids were groomed before, mm-hmm. in terms of the internet, is that it's not just the access that people have to children, it's the access they have to information about them. I mean, these kids are putting so much about their lives out there. Wow. So you can have a person, I mean, literally they can just scroll for 30 seconds and say, oh, you know, this kid had a grandparent who died.
Right.
And there can be sort of this false sense, this, you know, trauma bonds that
right.
is pretty easy to, you know, oh, I saw that you had this happen. This happened to me. And I was so sad. I just wanted to say hi, you know, and it really, it's enormous. It is this psychologically, the grooming is the same, but mm-hmm. the tools that we are giving predators to do the grooming with social media is not the same. That's what's really different. You know, it used to be hard to kind of find a kid, right?
No, we're making it easy.
Right. Now we're making it really easy. And we're making it really easy for a false sense of intimacy to be created.
Yeah.
Within a matter of, you know, hours, if, you know, if not minutes.
Right. Right.
That was something in my reporting that, and I, you know, I have kids as well. That was something where I was like, this is a real problem.
Oh,
this is a real problem. And this is not just sending a nude, right?
Yeah.
This
yeah.
is just talking about your regular life. You know,
right,
that is,
right.
your
Let's
kids
be friends.
Are sort of endangering
yeah.
themselves
yeah.
by
yeah.
doing that if someone wants to take advantage. So,
right.
Yeah. The majority of these predators are not, they call it a gorilla pimp, which is basically the abuse of hitting you, beating you. Like, they're not. It's the romantic. It's the Romeo pimp, right?
Yeah.
That's the majority of them, you know?
Yeah.
I love you. I make you feel important. I give you
right.
all the things you need.
Yeah.
And then you just have to sell your body for it.
Yeah. And can you talk for a minute, Nikki, about the profile of the pedophiles, the psychological profile of these people? The guy who lives in a, you know, has a nice family and, you know, has a good job and has children, and yet at night or whenever goes on the internet and starts like trying to create relationships with kids that he doesn't even know. I mean, Where does that come from? Is that trauma based also?
I think most people would like to assume that they've all been abused themselves or there's some kind of traumatic trauma history. But that's really not necessarily the case. I mean, that happens, obviously. Yeah. But just like I said, I mean, when Stephen Boland walked up and I saw a guy that could be sitting next to me in my next cubicle, I don't think that there is. I mean, he had a good job, a family. I think that's the scariest thing is that you can't necessarily have a profile.
Right. So a pedophile doesn't look a certain way or behave a certain way.
No, I mean, they're doctors, they're priests, they're office people, they're truck drivers, they're everyone.
Wow.
So it's very difficult to try and pinpoint like a certain person that you could look out for, unfortunately.
Right.
Which I guess is the part of the scary part. I will tell you that in the course of my work, I've only arrested two women. So the majority have been males. Mm-hmm. But I did have two cases, two women, mothers that were molesting and trafficking their children.
Wow. How often is the family of the victim complicit in the trafficking? Is that something that you see often or not?
What I can say to that is that out of all of the cases that I've worked, I've only had one wife, one mother of children actually come to a sentencing and encourage the highest sentence possible because of what he had done to children, could have done to their children. And that was only one.
Okay.
So that goes to say that I think that most of them want to, I think most families want to ignore the problem, stick their head in the sand, they are complicit in, I guess, in that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, we talked a lot about sort of intergenerational trafficking, Nikki, and how, you know, you'll have a family where a grandmother trafficked a mother who then traffics it's sort of the cyclical problem. I don't know if that's exactly what you're asking about, Ralph, but that was something really surprising to me.
Yeah.
That was a big thing about when we spoke with Kay, one of the victims that we talked about in the interview, that it was familial abuse. Trafficking. And so it was basically handed down by generations. And I think that's pretty frequent. It's more frequent than you would think.
It is. Wow. Because you hear about that. I mean, I've heard of it. I've heard of it through like church groups or, you know, members of certain societies and so on and so forth. And you hear about these cases, but you don't know if it's real or not. And you're basically saying that there is a lot of that. It is real.
Yes.
Wow.
I think the stats are basically like 45%.
Uh-huh.
That's about what my reporting showed, yeah. Uh-huh. As high as 44% of victims are trafficked by family members.
Uh-huh. And intergenerational.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Between 2011 and 2020, there was an 84% increase in the number of people prosecuted for a federal human trafficking offense. Of the defendants charged in 2020, 92% were male, 63% were white, 66% had no prior convictions, and 95% were U.S. citizens. According to the United States Sentencing Commission, the average sentence for offenders convicted of production of child pornography was 277 months, and the average sentence for offenders convicted of travel to engage in prohibited sexual conduct with a minor was 152 months. How can we better combat this, aside from just doing what you did so bravely and effectively, going undercover and finding these people? How can we deal with it in a bigger way? I mean, certainly writing articles like what you've done, Nikki, is one way, spreading awareness. But, you know, what do we do?
I mean, it's a societal problem. Yeah. And there are a lot of resources that are out there. I think promoting those resources, in addition to spreading awareness, are the biggest things. I personally also think that we need to talk to children about it.
Yeah.
I think that we need to get more in touch with our teenagers that are the most vulnerable of our society, and spreading awareness so that they can not fall into the traps is probably would be huge.
Yeah. You know, you see it in advertising, you see it in film, you see it in TV shows. It just seems to sort of, you know, sexualize kids when, at an age when they're not even aware of of sex, right? And yet, you know, just the way they're encouraged to dress and behave. And, you know, for normal people, you're not thinking of them as sexual objects, right? So you're just going, well, you know, I don't know, that's kind of a little explicit outfit or a little too tight or whatever it is. But clearly for these people who are pedophiles and are looking at children that way, it's an enticement, I would think.
Yeah.
And we're, as a society, sort of encouraging that.
I mean, I think that's been going on for decades. Yeah. I mean, that's, you know, this is, I wouldn't say that that is a new thing. I will say there has been a lot of research recently that looks at how children are getting onto social media and they're encountering social situations of all different kinds.
Yeah.
That they are not, their developmentally, their brains are not equipped to handle those kinds of interactions. And certainly any kind of sexual interaction would fall in that category.
Yeah.
So I think that, you know, my kids are not quite there yet. Mm-hmm. And I do think a lot about how to deal with this. I mean, I have decided for my own kids that we will not be using social media until, I mean, I'd be fine with them not using until they go to college,
but
there will be a point when I lose the battle.
Yeah, there was an age limit before you could have a Facebook profile and so on and so forth. And we had to watch it all the time.
You have to recognize that no matter what the rules are in your own home, if you ever let your child leave the home, they're going to be online.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is. So.
Yeah.
I think it is really important. And I should say that while I was researching this story, Nikki put me in touch with a woman, Cindy Mallott. Am I saying it right?
Mallott. Yeah, Mallott.
Who does a lot of work in the area of child trafficking. And she was very clear that we need to be, no matter what the rules are in your own home, you need to be talking to your kids about this stuff. And in fact, she recommended a book for me to read, which I have ordered, not read yet, but I think it's actually called How to Talk to Your Kids About Pornography. Mm-hmm. You know, unfortunately, I just think we live in a time when we have to do that.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think pretty early. I mean, I think 10, 11 is not too early to start that conversation.
That's right.
And this is a question I have, is how many parents are afraid to look at their own child's phone?
Mm. Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, seriously, like, we feel like it's rude that, right?
Violation of privacy.
Their privacy. Right. You're like, you're disrespecting their privacy.
Right.
But they're not capable of understanding the world, unfortunately, that we are working within, right? Yeah. I myself have looked at my child's phone in the past and been pretty appalled, to be very honest with you. And so I don't think that as parents in general, trying to protect our children, that's a bad thing.
No, absolutely not. Yeah. I mean, I think it, in a sense, it kind of falls on parents, right? Because technology is so ahead of our ability to monitor it. You know, we have to do it at the home, because if we don't, you know, nobody else is going to do it for us.
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think too, one thing that Nikki and Cindy and I talked about was that, unfortunately, stranger danger doesn't really work. I mean, it might work with a three-year-old in the park, right? They're not going to go up to someone they don't know. Right. But when you're talking about tweens and teens, you know, they're at a developmental stage where they want something new. That's sure. actually what they're going online to find.
Yeah, well, they're learning. Yeah, they want to engage the world. And yeah.
Yeah. And they, and so, you know, what Cindy said is that it's very important not to focus on teaching kids stranger danger,
yeah.
but teaching them to be very aware of times when they are being subtly manipulated.
Yes.
Being asked to do things that they may not be entirely comfortable with, right. being asked to do things that they know might not be a good idea. And that kids are far more, I mean, no kid wants to feel like they're being played, right?
Yeah,
so
sure.
that's a much more effective way of
right.
training kids to be on the lookout for potentially predatory or grooming behavior.
According to Cindy Mallett, director of U.S. SAFE programs at Crisis Aid International, and I quote, "Recruiters used to have to work really hard to get access to kids, but now they're practically sitting in a child's bedroom. And predators aren't just on Instagram and Snapchat. They lurk in the chat functions of Roblox, Minecraft, and Grand Theft Auto. They're everywhere," Cindy says. "And kids share everything online. What's going on in their lives, who they're angry at, how they feel about their parents, how they spend their time, and the insecurities they feel about their bodies and themselves. It's like a gift to the predators." Nikki, talk about the role of broken homes, abuse, foster care, you know, that whole system in our country, and another growing problem that we have to face, and how much of that plays into children's vulnerability to predators.
Well, I think we already kind of touched on the fact that it's not necessarily just going to be inner city poverty, foster home, broken families type of situation. However, that is a larger percentage. Mm-hmm. Because as we've been discussing, they're more vulnerable
yeah.
to being groomed and manipulated to get into this kind of lifestyle. And then once they are, then there's a whole other aspect to the shame of being there and how you get out, right? Like getting out of it is a whole other deal, right?
Yeah. And kids in foster care are so vulnerable because, you know, there's no parent, there's nobody to really appeal to.
Well, and there's also the fact that some people get into foster care for the wrong reasons. And so you have,
yeah,
we did an operation about 3 years ago with child services, where mm-hmm. we basically called on all of these foster families and how many were saying that the children were with them and getting paid and they weren't. They were out being trafficked. And so they were lying and saying that these children were with them, but they were actually on the streets. And we found many trafficked children through doing that operation.
Wow. Let's talk a little bit about the case of Karina Ellison, because that, I think, is obviously somebody that you became very close to and very involved in.
Yes.
And it went through various different stages, your relationship with her.
Yes. You know, what's so amazing, and I think, you know, when we're having this conversation about such a very difficult, widespread societal problem that we have no real easy answers to, but we're constantly trying to work on, what's great about Karina is that she's a success story, right?
Yeah.
Like, so she, from a generational abusive familial trafficking individual. And what's interesting is that even in having some conversations with her, she didn't even look at herself as a victim at certain points. And that's, I think, a big thing with a lot of these girls, boys, victims that they blame themselves a lot.
Yeah.
And even be able to get themselves to be able to look at the fact that this wasn't a boyfriend that you were just doing something for because he was treating you nicely. Like, he was taking advantage of you and selling you your body for money, for him.
Yeah.
Like, it takes time to even get them to understand that. And yeah. I think the fact that she has come so far around that process where she has a family of her own, where she's looking out for her own and concerned for her own children regarding all of these things, right?
Yeah.
Is something that is important to put out there for other people to give them hope.
Mm-hmm. What is she doing now? How is she doing now?
She's doing well. She's pregnant with her third child. She's happily married.
Fantastic.
And she's really processing all of this. I think us going through this article together and really going back, and she's remembering a lot of things that she repressed,
mm-hmm.
Which is difficult, but I think she's finding it to be healthy.
Karina Ellison, who Nikki referred to earlier, was first trafficked when she was 4 or 5 years old. She later learned that her grandmother scored drugs by trafficking her mother. And she remembers how her mom was hooked on meth, cooked by a man who lived with them. Years later, her father died of an overdose. Her mom lost legal custody, and Karina bounced from one foster care home to another. She was lured back into sex trafficking as a teenager by a woman who posted her services on Backpage. It was an awful life. No one was looking for her. Karina didn't know where to go for help until she met Nikki, who had recently been named head of the FBI's Child Exploitation Joint Task Force. And talk about the psychic toll it takes for people like yourself, Nikki, to do this work, because this is dark stuff. This is, you know, difficult.
It is. I would say that it's a double-edged sword in the fact that I'm not really sure there are many other criminal violations you could work that would be more profound or more rewarding than doing something like this and being able to put these individuals away for harming our children.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, while you're doing it, you have to put it in a Pandora's box to be able to just go in and do it every day. And I think over time, you don't realize the toll that it takes.
Yeah.
So I remember being when I stopped doing it in Atlanta for a couple of years, and I was removed and working on drug cases. It was about 6 months. I had to go back and do a trial, and I had been removed from this work for 6 months.
Yeah.
And I had to go and prepare for trial, so I had to review all the evidence. And this is a long-winded answer to your story. Sorry. But I remember it just being like really like devastating. Like, I remember it hitting me like, oh my gosh, like I hadn't looked at this in 6 months. And now I was looking at it again and I was thinking, how did I do this every day? Right.
Yeah.
So, I think that's just our mental toughness sometimes mm-hmm. to be able to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think that it's healthy for anybody to do it for a certain period of time.
I wouldn't think so. And also to be raising a family.
Right.
I mean, you're seeing probably predators everywhere because you are.
Right.
And it's hard. I mean, I think as a society to wrap our heads around this issue that it's so widespread.
And I think most people don't really even want to know, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's very surprising, is that it's too unpleasant to wrap their heads around.
Right. Too hard to comprehend. So it's easier to stick your head in the sand. I think that's what a lot of people do, honestly.
Yeah. Okay. Can you talk about Innocent Warriors? That's an organization that you founded.
Right. I founded that at the cusp of ending my career with the FBI, hoping that I would be able to continue working in a variety of ways with victims as mentors and awareness program. And so that's why I founded Innocent Warriors, and having people involved like Karina and other victims and working with schools and awareness and doing the projects that Alex and I are doing now is a way to continue helping victims from a different avenue.
Uh-huh. And Alex, how were you involved in terms of spreading awareness and certainly your article?
Well, it's funny because normally when I do a story like this, I will write it and then kind of, you know, move on.
Sure.
To the next thing. And I have moved on to, you know, I am working on another story, but with this one, Nikki and I have stayed in touch and we'll continue to stay in touch. I think, you know, I see my role as being able to get messages out. Mm-hmm. And so that's something that I am hoping that we can continue to do. I'm not sure exactly what that looks like yet, mm-hmm. but I felt like I learned a lot doing this article and working with Nikki. And I definitely don't have the tools that she has to help victims or to understand the systems that are in place and mm-hmm. how those systems work. But one thing that we talked about actually is that when it comes to victim services, there's a real patchwork in this country. And a lot of places are working, I don't want to say at odds with each other, but there's not a lot of coordination.
So there's not a national sort of organization.
Right. And also, you know, there's different organizations that can, they can only work in their state, or they only have funding for this type of situation, or they only, you know, if someone was, and some of this trafficking does, you know, people go from state to state.
Right. They move around.
Yeah. Yeah. They move around. And so someone might, you know, Nikki's team might have found a victim in St. Louis, but then, you know, they're really from another state. So how do you get them the services that they need?
Right.
That's something that I've thought about a lot since doing this story. And, you know, again, like I'm a member of the media, my job, I don't have a background in this field,
right.
but I am committed to continuing to sort of get the word out. And I think one thing that as Innocent Warriors grows, you know, it would be amazing if there were an organization that was advocating some sort of end to the patchwork system or some sort of federal umbrella.
Yeah, it seems absolutely needed.
Yeah, that made it easier for these victims to get the help they need when they need it and how they need it.
Okay. Nikki, let's talk about the law enforcement side of this for a minute, because you mentioned in the article that the number of arrests has gone dramatically up over the last, I think, since 2010 or 2011. How much resources is law enforcement dedicating to this problem? Is it just the FBI? Are there other agencies involved?
Yes. The FBI, it depends on the, it's different between divisions as far as how many resources they allot to it, depending on their particular crime problem in their city. I do know that the FBI is very dedicated to their task force operations in the different offices, which helps exponentially expand resources. Mm-hmm. For example, with mine, I mean, I had 20 detectives working in three different jurisdictions mm-hmm. that helped to, I mean, at one point there was only two agents, but I had 20 detectives working. Yeah. So, and I think that's probably pretty common, for most offices, but, you know, you have HSI works on the cases too. Secret Service sometimes works on the cases as well. You have a lot of federal agencies that are putting resources into work in these type of cases.
Mm-hmm. And what about local law enforcement?
Well, like I said, I mean, we had 20 detectives working within St. Louis City, St. Louis County, and St.
Like police, you know, police departments, are they?
Right.
I guess it depends on the jurisdiction.
Yes, it does. We had St. Louis City, we had St. Louis County, we had St. Charles County, all local detectives that were working on our task force work in these cases proactively.
Mm-hmm. Fantastic. So there's more awareness. It sounds like there's more resources being dedicated to the problem.
Absolutely. And a lot of training that goes on within those jurisdictions as well.
Sure.
Yeah, we've talked about the online undercover work that Nikki's team did, but we haven't talked about the actual sting ops that that y'all put in place.
So in general, at least two, three, four times a month, we would do a sting operation over the course of a day or two. And we would get three hotel rooms, and it could be anything from a Red Roof to the Ritz-Carlton in the fanciest part of the county. And we would have one of the detectors would be the John. We would have the room wired up for video and audio. And then they would go online for particular ads that look like young individuals. And then make calls basically for some dates, basically, is what they would be called. We as an arrest team would be in the room next door. And then once the individual showed up and then the arrest word, whatever it would be, motorcycle or whatever word that was chosen by the undercover, we would go in and then we would. So I say arrest, but we were not there to arrest the victims.
Yeah.
We would have surveillance in the parking lot to see if there was a pimp that dropped them off so that we could make contact with that individual. And then the third room would be a where we would have our social service people like Cindy Mallett that would be in there to, as opposed to locking these girls up, girls or boys up, to provide them with resources to help them.
Yeah. So it's pretty comprehensive. So you're arresting the John and counseling the children, basically. Right. Yeah, that's fantastic. And that's very effective, you find?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
It has been. I mean, not all of the, it's hard to get, I mean, and mind you, we there's adults and children that we would end up with in these operations. And regardless of whether they're adults or children, we were still trying to provide them with resources to give them alternatives to that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm. Now, I know in drug busts, you always try to get the people to give information about their bosses and, you know, higher ups within the organization, right, the cartel or whatever it is. Does any of that take place?
Yes.
It does.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, so when you're, so say for example, we've, you know, a 20-year-old shows up, and we try and get as much information as we can about whether or not she knows about child trafficking, whether or not she knows that her children being trafficked, like what her pimp is doing. Obviously, we try to get as much intelligence as we possibly can when we're doing those interviews. And sometimes they talk and sometimes they don't.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Johns? Are they generally operating on their own, or are they connected to larger networks?
It probably depends on where you're at.
Okay.
But I think generally speaking, they're individual. And we don't generally go after the Johns, honestly, because we're more concerned about the victims and the larger trafficking scale.
Okay. So the Johns are not arrested, generally?
The Johns are not part of our operation. Our detective is the John.
Oh, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, the Johns aren't part of our operation.
Are you planning to write any follow-up articles to this? Have you gotten a big response to your article in the Rolling Stone?
I have to say this article has gotten a very big response. We've had a lot of a lot of people, and a lot of people writing in to say that they learned a lot and they appreciated the information that was in the story. You know, a lot of people, and I know Nikki has had a lot of people, again, she's not good at tooting her own horn, but I know she's had a lot of people reaching out to her, mm-hmm. you know, saying thank you for her work. And it was, I mean, when I was interviewing her, we were talking about things that were, I could tell, you know, I'm reading the room when I'm interviewing someone.
Yeah.
And we would sometimes just have to stop because it was really digging up, things that were really hard to discuss.
Sure.
And so one of the things that I really respect about Nikki is that she has kept going back. You know, I think she's right. There's a limited amount of time that a person can do this kind of work.
Yeah.
But she knows that she has expertise that other people don't have. And so I think with that knowledge, it's hard for her not to sort of continue to put herself back in, you know? Yeah. I mean, that's certainly what Innocent Warriors is about. Yeah. But going back to the sort of sting operations, is that Nikki's team, from what I've determined from her and talking to other people, they were very sort of trauma-centered. You know, having that social worker in the next room was, you know, I assume there's probably other teams that do that, but I don't think that that's true across the board. Mm-hmm. And I think it's worth mentioning that that process can be very long and hard as well. It's not like, you know, you get a victim in the room with a social worker and all of a sudden the floodgates open and they tell you all about their lives and they're so happy that you're there to save them, you know? And so a lot of times I think it would be, you know, basically trying to figure out a way to stay in contact with the victim.
Yeah.
You know, whether it be, here, can you put this number in your phone under this fake name? So if your trafficker sees the number, they're not, or the name, they're not suspicious or whatever. Mm-hmm. But you know, can you check, like, if there are times when you don't feel safe, can you text this number and tell us where you are?
Yeah.
You know, I don't think there was the expectation that one intervention was going to do the trick
right.
with these cases.
Right.
But it would be a lot of kind of repeated, trying to have repeated contact, trying to offer women, and also I think it's very important to say that some of the victims are men as well, or male.
Sure. What would you say is the percentage?
Yeah, Nikki, what would you say?
It's a smaller percentage, but I think there's also, I think this is a smaller percentage from what we've seen.
Okay.
I also think that law enforcement probably has targeted males less than females in sting operations, from my experience, from what I've seen.
Mm-hmm. And I did talk to Nikki and some other detectives about that, and there is awareness that that's a problem.
Yeah.
That these sting operations, I mean, a lot of the people playing the Johns are men who, and certainly they're, you know, sometimes they would try to set up a date, and I use that with air quotes, with what they presumed was an underage male. But, you know, a lot of the time it was just sort of the default to set it up with what they presumed to be an underage female.
Sure.
But when I talked to people, like I said, there was an awareness about this, but it was like, we can't even, there's more cases than we can manage doing what we're already doing.
Yeah.
With the resources we have, it's hard to know how to expand.
Yeah. Yeah.
Although we know we do need to expand was sort of the message I got about that.
Right. So the problem is even bigger than what we're addressing and what we're aware of.
Well, I mean, they were doing multiple sting operations a month, and you know, it was there. And then you have to process, you know, you have to,
right.
it's not like the work is done once you leave that hotel room.
Right.
But yeah, and that is again where social services come in. Just staying in touch with victims, making, you know, saying, here's where you can go to get food, or here's where you can go to get medical care if you need it.
I think honestly, Alex, you make a very, very good point, as I think that our task force was probably one of few that actually have that as part of our operation. And I think that nationally, that would be really good to set up and would help us be more successful in helping some of these victims get out of the life and helping these cases be more successful, so to speak.
Yeah,
I think it's more unique than you realize.
Well, it seems to me, from listening to the both of you and reading the article, one of the most important things we can do is just educate people, and especially children.
Yes.
So that they're aware of how vulnerable they are. They're aware that there are predators on the internet, and how to pick up the words, the techniques that they use, you know, and go away. You know, they're not your, realize they're not your friends. And even though it's a very difficult subject to bring up with kids and even parents, it's absolutely necessary, because right now the predators, it seems, have the advantage of technology and websites. So it's really up to us to spread awareness and for people to be comfortable talking about this among themselves and with their children.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And I was under the impression that there were just certain websites and social media places that these predators, you know, I assumed going into this story,
yeah,
probably Snapchat is a big one because the evidence disappears, right? If you're a predator, that's very appealing.
Yeah.
But, you know, what I've learned and was told is that that is a misconception. Mm-hmm. And to assume that it's only this one or that one or, you know, Instagram or whatever, you don't want to let your guard down and think like, oh, if I just monitor these, I'm fine, because predators are popping up wherever they can.
Yeah.
You know, they're in the chat function of Minecraft. They're in, you know, it's not places that you would necessarily, I mean, of course it is happening where you would assume it is happening.
Right.
But it's not just there.
It's also on PlayStation. It's also on Roblox.
And the child pornography is also another insidious problem that has to be stopped as well, because it seems one sort of feeds the other.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, Ralph, you were talking earlier about like different vulnerabilities that make children susceptible to grooming. And one of them is absolutely having shared compromising photos. I mean, if you can get a kid to send you a compromising photo, they will do almost anything to keep you from sending that photo to all of their contacts on social, to their teacher and their parents and their grandmother, you know?
Yeah.
So,
extortion is a huge problem.
Yeah.
Extortion is a huge problem.
Using photographs.
To extort them. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Once they send one photo, then they feel like they are captured.
Yeah.
By all the threats of what else will happen. And then they just continue, it continues into just this whole snowball effect.
Wow.
And so you can get someone then to be, you know, to perform sexual acts because you've got this hold over them.
Right.
And they'll do kind of whatever you say.
Yeah. Absolutely horrible. I can't thank you both enough for what you've done, Nikki, in your career, and Alex for writing this article and spreading awareness.
Nikki is the real hero here.
Yeah.
I'm just the messenger. She's the one who's done the real work.
Yeah. Years
and years. I appreciate that. And Alex is now being self-deprecating as well. So,
no, Nikki, you're sort of the explorer into this dark world and going into it and coming back and kind of warning us like, hey, this is what's going on. It's not what you see in the films, like maybe some of that happens, but it's going on in your neighborhood, in your school.
Absolutely. I'm glad that I had an opportunity to have a voice, and especially with Alex being so amazing.
Every year in the United States, thousands of child trafficking cases are reported, but thousands more go unnoticed. And the victims of these crimes are often forgotten or don't know where to turn for help. That's why Nikki Baldellato, following her retirement from the FBI, has founded Innocent Warriors LLC. It's an organization dedicated to spreading awareness of this horrific problem and rescuing the victims and providing them with the help and resources they need to build a better life. Nikki writes, and I quote, "The harsh reality is there's a 95% recidivism rate for these victims. It has been my hope for many years that after my career, I could utilize the firsthand knowledge and experience I have to create a program that will lower that unfortunately high number." We thank Nikki for her 20 plus year career in the FBI, and especially the work she's done with the Child Exploitation Joint Task Force. And we thank Alex Morris for her courageous and important recent article in Rolling Stone magazine that tells the real story of underage sex trafficking in the United States today. It's my great honor to name former FBI undercover agent Nikki Badalato, and reporter Alex Morris as today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Fazzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.